Part 2. The Edge. Chapter 1. They brought her to an ending in a crowded cemetery, where the gravestones cried for breath. The mass had been lonely as her life. Her brothers from Brooklyn, the grocer on the corner who'd extended her credit, watching them lower her into the dark of a world without windows. Damien Karras sobbed with a grief he had long misplaced.
Ah, Dimmy, Dimmy.
An uncle with an arm around his shoulder.
Never mind, she's in heaven now, Dimmy. She's happy.
Oh, God, let it be. Ah, God. Ah, please, oh, God, please be. They waited in the car while he lingered by the grave. He couldn't bear the thought of her being alone. Driving to Pennsylvania Station, he listened to his uncles speak of their illnesses in broken immigrant accents.
Emphysema. You know, I gotta quit smoking. I almost died last year, you know that.
Spasms of rage fought to break from his lips, but he pressed them back and felt ashamed. He looked out the window. They were passing by the home relief station, where on Saturday mornings in the dead of winter, she would pick up the milk and the sacks of potatoes while he lay in his bed. The Central Park Zoo, where she left him in summer while she begged by the fountain in front of the plaza. Passing the hotel, Karras burst into sobs and then choked back the memories, wiped at the wetness of stinging regrets. He wondered why love had waited for this distance, waited for the moment when he need not touch, when the limits of contact and human surrender had dwindled to the size of a Prentice mask card tucked in his wallet. In memoriam. He knew. This grief was old. He arrived at Georgetown in time for dinner, but had no appetite. He paced inside his cottage. Jesuit friends came by with condolences, stayed briefly, promised prayers. Shortly after 10, Joe Dyer appeared with a bottle of scotch. He displayed it proudly. Give us Regal.
Where'd you get the money for it, Joe? Out of the poor box?
Don't be an asshole, that would be breaking my vow of poverty.
Where did you get it, then?
I stole it. Karras smiled and shook his head as he fetched a glass and a pewter coffee mug, rinsed them out in his tiny bathroom sink.
I believe you, he said hoarsely.
Greater faith have I never seen, echoed Dyer. Karras felt a stab of familiar pain. He shook it off and returned to Dyer, who was sitting on his cot breaking open the seal on the bottle of scotch. He sat beside him.
Would you like to absolve me now or later? Asked Dyer. Just pour and we'll absolve each other.
Dyer poured deep into glass and cup.
College president shouldn't drink, he murmured.
It sets a bad example. I figure I relieved him of a terrible temptation.
Karras swallowed scotch, but not the story.
He knew the president's ways too well. A man of tact and sensitivity, he always gave through indirection. Dyer had come, he knew, as a friend, but also as the president's personal emissary. Dyer was good for him, made him laugh, talked about the party and Chris McNeil, purveyed new anecdotes about the Jesuit prefect of discipline. He drank very little, but continually replenished Karras's glass. And when he thought he was numb enough for sleep, he got up from the cot and made Karras stretch out, while he sat at the desk and continued to talk until Karras's eyes were closed and his comments were mumbled grunts. Then Dyer stood up, undid the laces of Karras's shoes, and slipped them off.
Gonna steal my shoes now, Karras muttered thickly.
No, I tell fortunes by reading the creases. Now shut up and go to sleep.
You're a Jesuit cat burglar.
Dyer laughed lightly, covered Karras with a coat that he had taken from a closet, Listen, someone's got to worry about the bills around this place. All you other guys do is rattle your rosary beads for the winos down on M Street. Karras made no answer. His breathing now was regular and deep. Dyer moved quietly to the door and flicked out the light. "Stealing is a sin," muttered Karras in the darkness. "Mea culpa," Dyer said softly. For a time he waited, then at last decided that Karras was asleep, and he left the cottage. In the middle of the night, Karras awakened in tears. He had dreamed of his mother. Standing at a window high in Manhattan, he'd seen her emerging from a subway kiosk across the street. She stood at the curb with a brown paper shopping bag and was searching for him, calling out his name. Karras waved to her. She didn't see him. She wandered the street. Buses, trucks, unfriendly crowds. She was growing frightened. She returned to the subway and began to descend. Karras grew frantic, ran to the street and began to weep as he called her name, as he could not find her, as he pictured her helpless and bewildered in a maze of tunnels beneath the ground. He waited for his sobbing to subside and then fumbled for the scotch. He sat on the cot and drank in darkness. Wet came the tears. They would not cease. This was like childhood, this grief. He remembered a telephone call from his uncle.
"Dimmy, that demon had affected her brain. She don't let a doctor come anywhere near. She just keeps screaming things, Dimmy. She even talked to the goddamn radio. I figured that she gotta go to Bellevue, Dimmy. Regular doctor won't put up with that. I just figure a couple of months and she's good and new. Then we take her out again, okay? Listen, Dimmy, we already done it. They give her a shot and they take her in the ambulance this morning. Didn't want to bother you, except there's going to be a hearing in the court. You got to sign the papers."
"What? Private hospital?
Who's got the money for that, Dimmy? You?"
Karras didn't remember falling asleep. He awakened in torpor, with memory of loss draining blood from his brain. He reeled to the bathroom, showered, shaved, dressed in a cassock. It was 5:35. He unlocked the door to Holy Trinity, put on his vestments, and offered up mass at the left side altar. "Memento etiam," he prayed with bleak despair. "Remember thy servant Mary Karras." In the tabernacle door, he saw the face of the nurse at Bellevue receiving, heard again the screams from the isolation room.
"You her son?"
"Yes, I'm Damien Karras."
"Well, I wouldn't go in there. She's pitching a fit."
He'd looked through the port at the windowless room with the naked light bulb hanging from the ceiling. Padded walls, no furniture save for the cot on which she raved.
"Grant her, we pray thee, a place of refreshment, light, and peace."
As she saw him and met his gaze, she'd grown suddenly silent, then got out of the bed and slowly moved to the small round glass observation port, her expression baffled, hurt.
"Why you do this to me, Dimmy? Why?"
The eyes had been meeker than a lamb's.
"On your stay," Karras murmured, as he bowed his head and struck his breast with a fist. "Lamb of God, who takest away the sins of the world, grant her rest."
Moments later, as he closed his eyes and held up the host, he saw his mother in the hearing room, her little hands clasped gentle in her lap, her expression docile and confused as the judge explained to her the Bellevue psychiatrist report.
"You understand that, Mary?"
She'd nodded, wouldn't open her mouth. They had taken her dentures.
"Well, what do you say about that, Mary?"
She'd proudly answered the judge. "My boy, he speak for me." An anguished moan escaped Karras's lips as he bowed his head above the host. He struck his breast as if it were the years that he wanted to turn back as he murmured,
Domine non sum dignus, say what the word in my soul shall be healed. Against all reason, against all knowledge, he prayed there was someone to hear his prayer. He did not think so. After the Mass, he returned to the cottage and tried to sleep, without success.
Later in the morning, a youngish priest that he'd never seen before came by unexpectedly. He knocked and looked in through the open door.
You busy, Father Karras? Can I see you for a while?
In the eyes, the restless burden, in the voice, the tugging plea. For an instant, Karras hated him. Come in, he said gently,
and inwardly raged at this portion of his being that so frequently rendered him helpless in the face of someone's plea, that he could not control, that lay coiled within him like a length of rope, always ready to fling itself out to rescue at the call of someone else's need. It gave him no peace, not even in sleep. At the edge of his dreams, there was often a sound like the faint, distant cry of someone in distress, and for minutes after waking, he would feel the anxiety of some duty unfulfilled. The young priest fumbled, faltered, seemed shy. Karras led him patiently, offered cigarettes, instant coffee, then forced a look of interest as the moody young visitor gradually unfolded a very familiar problem, the terrible loneliness of priests. Of all the anxieties that Karras encountered among the community, this one had lately become the most prevalent. Cut off from their families as well as from women, many of the Jesuits were also fearful of expressing affection for fellow priests, of forming deep and loving friendships.
You know, Father, like I'd like to put my arm around another guy's shoulder, but right away I'm scared he's going to think I'm queer. I mean, you hear all these stories about so many latents attracted to the priesthood. I just don't do it. I won't even go to somebody's room just to listen to records or talk or smoke. Not that I'm afraid of him. I'm just worried about him getting worried about me.
Karras felt the weight shifting slowly from the young priest and onto him. He let it come. He let him talk. He knew he would return to him again and again to find relief from loneliness, to make Karras his friend. And when he'd realized he had done so without fear and suspicion, perhaps he would then go on to make friends among the others. Growing weary, Karras found himself drifting into private sorrow. He glanced at a plaque that someone had given him the previous Christmas. My brother hurts. I share his pain. I meet God in him. For Karras, a failed encounter. He blamed himself. He had mapped the streets of his brother's torment, yet never had walked them, or so he believed. He thought that the pain he felt was his own. At last a visitor looked at his watch. It was time for lunch in the campus refectory. He rose, and as he started to leave, he glanced at the cover of a current novel on Karras's desk.
Oh, you've got Shadows, he said.
Oh, yeah, have you read it? Karras asked him. The young priest shook his head.
No, I haven't. Should I?
I don't know. I just finished it, and I'm not at all sure that I really understand it, Karras lied. He picked up the book and handed it over.
Here, you want to take this along? You know, I'd really like to hear someone else's opinion.
Oh, well, sure, said the Jesuit, examining the copy on the inner flap of the dust jacket. I'll try to get it back to you in a couple of days. The young Jesuit's mood seemed brighter. As the screen door creaked with the young priest's departure, Karras felt relief and peace. He picked up his breviary and stepped out to the courtyard where he slowly paced and said his daily office prayers. In the afternoon, he had still another visitor, the elderly pastor of Holy Trinity Church, who took a chair by the desk and offered condolences on the passing of Karis's mother.
"Oh, I said a couple of masses for her, Damien. One for you as well," he wheezed with a lilting Irish brogue.
"That was thoughtful of you, Father. Thank you so much. How old was she, Damien?"
70. "Ah, well, that's a good old age."
Karis felt a faint flash of anger.
"Oh, really?"
He turned his gaze to an altar card that the pastor had carried in with him. One of three employed in the Mass, it was covered in plastic and inscribed with a portion of the prayers that were said by the priest. Karis wondered why the pastor had brought it in. The answer came soon.
"Well, Damien, we've had another one of those things here today. And in the church, you know, another desecration."
A statue of the Virgin Mary at the left side altar of the church had been painted over and made to look like a harlot, the pastor told him. Then he handed the altar card to Karis.
"And then this was found in mid-morning, right after you'd gone, you know, to New York. Was it, what is this, Saturday?"
Yes, it was Saturday.
"Well, will you take a look at it, Damien? I just had a talk with a sergeant of police." "Ah, well, never mind that now. Have a look at this card for me, Damien, would you?"
As Karis examined the card, the pastor explained that someone had slipped in a typewritten sheet between the original card and its cover. The ersatz text, though containing some strikeovers and various typographical errors, was in fluent and intelligible Latin and described in vivid, erotic detail an imaginary homosexual encounter involving Mary Magdalene and the Blessed Virgin Mary.
"Oh, well, that's enough now. You don't have to read it all," said the pastor, snapping back the card as if fearing that it might be an occasion of sin for Karis. "Now, that's excellent Latin. I mean, it's got style. Don't you think of a church Latin style? Well, the sergeant says he talked to some fellow, a psychologist, and he says that the person's been doing all this. Well, he could be a priest, you know, a very sick priest. Damien, could he be right?"
Karis thought for a while. Then he nodded. Yes, it could. Acting out of rebellion, maybe, in a state of complete somnambulism. "I don't know, Father, but it could be, sure, maybe so.
Can you think of any candidates, Damien?"
"I don't get you."
"Well, now, sooner or later, they come and see you, wouldn't you say? I mean, the sick ones, if there are any, from the campus. Do you know any like that, Damien? I mean, with that sort of illness."
"No, I don't, Father."
No, I didn't think you'd tell me."
"No, I wouldn't. But on top of that, Father, somnambulism is a way of resolving any number of possible conflict situations, and the usual form of resolution is symbolic, so I really wouldn't know. And if it is a somnambulist, he'd probably have total posterior amnesia about what he's done, so that even he wouldn't have a clue."
"What if you were to tell him?" the pastor asked cagily.
He lightly plucked at an earlobe, a habitual gesture, Karis had noticed, whenever he thought he was being wily.
"I know of no one who fits the description," said Karis. "Yes, I see. Well, it's just as I expected."
The pastor stood up and started shuffling toward the door.
"You know what you're like, you people? You're like priests."
As Karis gently chuckled, the pastor returned and dropped the altar card on his desk.
"I suppose you could study this thing, don't you think?"
"Go ahead," he said as he turned and started away again, his shoulders hunched over with age.
"Did they check it for fingerprints?" Karis asked him.
The elderly pastor stopped and looked back.
"Oh, I doubt it. After all, it's not a criminal we're after now, is it? More likely, it's only a demented parishioner. What do you think of that, Damien? Do you think that it could be someone in the parish? You know, I'm thinking now. Now I'm thinking maybe that's so. No, it wasn't the priest. Not at all. It was someone among the parishioners."
He was pulling at his earlobe again.
"Don't you think?"
"I wouldn't know, Father. No. No, I didn't think you'd tell me. Later that day, Karras was relieved of his duties as counselor and assigned to the Georgetown University Medical School as a lecturer in psychiatry. His orders were to rest.